You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. When you think about your financial plans, are you diversified? After the year we had in 2022, it is a really good question. Is it time you rebalanced or made other adjustments? Help make sure your investing strategy is right for you. Visit planefe.com/hermoney to schedule your complimentary wealth checkup.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Jean Chatsky. Thanks so much for joining me today on Her Money. So it's been about a month since we have changed the format of the show based on all of your amazing feedback, the feedback that you provided in our 2023 survey. And so I want to know, what do you think? Are you liking the changes? Are the bits of news that we're giving you at the top of each show helpful? Are they working for you? Are you liking the length of the episodes as we've been playing with them? And are you happy that we've incorporated some other voices into Mailbag? We do our very best to make this the show that you want to listen to. We want to be a valuable resource in your lives. We want to help. So if you wouldn't mind, drop me an email at mailbag@hermoney.com, just a short one, and let me know what you think. In today's episode, I'm talking to Holly Trantham from The Financial Diet. She's got a surprising perspective on the meaning of financial success. I think you'll be very interested in that. Plus, if you've ever thought about what it would mean, pluses and minuses, to have a 4-day work week, The Financial Diet is one place that has committed to it. She'll fill us in. Then in Mailbag, we will hear from a listener who can't seem to get past the first round of job interviews, and we're going to dig into the finances of egg freezing. If you want to hear more about fertility and women's health, I want you to make sure to check out this week's episode of our other show, How She Does It, with Karen Feinerman. Her guest this week is the founder and CEO of Maven Clinic, Kate Ryder. It's a great conversation. Let's get into some news. Economists are now saying that the Fed may wait until September or later to cut interest rates this year. In a speech last week, Fed Reserve Chair Jay Powell said, "There has been a lack of further progress on lowering inflation back to the Fed's 2% target." And he noted that although the road isn't exactly linear, there is still hope. The risk here is that cutting rates too soon could have big drawbacks, potentially increasing inflation and requiring an even longer timeline to get back to that 2%. Leaving rates too high for too long, however, that increases the risk of a continued economic slowdown, which could bring on what everybody's been fearing for a long time, recession. We are keeping an eye on this delicate balancing act. Last Friday night, the highly anticipated fourth Bitcoin halving occurred. You may have heard the term halving. It has been in the news a bunch, but just in case you haven't, the halving, and it's basically cutting in half, it's a pre-programmed event that happens every few years, and it cuts the rate that Bitcoins are issued, as well as the rewards for Bitcoin miners, in half. If you are a long-term investor in the coin, You don't have to panic. Actually, it's likely to affect Bitcoin miners more than average individuals. And the good news is that previous halvings have caused the price of the coin to go up. We could see that over the next couple of months. Bitcoin has already had a pretty exciting start to 2024, leaping in price into the mid-$70,000 range before settling back where it is now in the mid-60s. If you are interested in learning more about investing, whether in alternatives like Bitcoin or stocks and bonds and ETFs, join me and Karen Feinerman for Investing Fix. It's our women-only investing club where we are building a portfolio together in a judgment-free, jargon-free space. If you sign up today, the first month's on me. Finally, if you are looking for less stress in your work life, maybe it's time to think about starting a business. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but research has shown that taking the plunge into entrepreneurship can actually lower your stress, improve your physical health, and provide you with a more meaningful career. And while the financial risks are enough to hold many people back from taking the plunge, a recent report from JP Morgan shows people who own businesses are wealthier than those who do not. And we're going to take a quick break. Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. When you take a look at your financial plans, are you diversified the way you want to be? And when is the last time you rebalanced your portfolio or made sure you're invested in the assets and allocation appropriate for you? Look, we all need to make tweaks and adjustments to our financial lives, sometimes small ones, sometimes big ones. Thankfully, Edelman Financial Engines can help, no matter what change your money might need most. Visit planefe.com/hermoney to learn more and schedule your complimentary wealth checkup. We are back. Here's my interview with Holly Trantham. Holly Trantham works at The Financial Diet, and The Financial Diet as a company was way ahead of the curve. They adopted a 4-day work week 2 years ago. They have never looked back. Holly's the creative director of The Financial Diet. She's been with the company since 2016. She is the author of their second book. It's called Beyond Getting By, The Financial Diet's Guide to Abundant and Intentional Living. And she's joining us today to talk about the positive changes that they've seen from adopting this model and a lot of other strategies that we can all use to create and pay for a life that we truly enjoy. Holly, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We actually had Chelsea Fagan, the founder of The Financial Diet, co-founder of The Financial Diet, on very early in our run. So it is a pleasure to meet you as well. Soon after you adopted the 4-day work week in 2021, Chelsea, who is the CEO of The Financial Diet, told Fortune, "You will never go back," that it boosted morale, that it boosted revenue. Now that we're 3 years down the road, what's it been like since you implemented this?
Yeah, you know, truthfully, I can't believe it's been 3 years. It feels like it was kind of the ethos of our company even before that. We always did summer Fridays. We've always been really respectful of everyone's time and our own work-life balance. So I really can't imagine going back. And I think that's very true for everybody on our team, especially we have mothers on our team. I know that it's a humongous game changer for them to be able to have a day a week that is not revolving around work or managing a child, especially if they have other childcare. So I think that the reason it's been able to work so long for us at this point is because we're all equally invested in it. And we're a small team, right? So we have to have a sense of ownership over our different areas. If one person isn't doing their job, it's going to be really obvious. At the same time, we have gotten into some issues at various points where one person is taking on more than they should be and accidentally going over the hours that we're supposed to be having every week. So we've been able to address those issues at the outset and have these conversations and reassess our workflow and what's working and what's not and get to the bottom of it, because we really don't want anybody to be working more than the 32 hours that we are allotted every week. I think we have a great team that's all just really respectful of each other's time and really respectful of setting meetings when only when they need to happen and keeping meetings to 15 minutes. They don't all have to be long, eliminating extra work that actually doesn't matter, and just like really assessing and making sure all of our time is going to the best use possible because we don't want to be going over that time.
Were there initial concerns about not being able to get everything done? And I'm really eager to hear more about the increased revenue and how you track that and how it happened.
Yeah, so there definitely were some concerns about people not being able to get things done. I should say, because we had a CEO and have a CEO who was herself so invested in the experiment, she doesn't want to work more. So she was invested in making sure everybody else is also at the same, working at the same level. So I think that we just, from the outset, we were tracking our time pretty consistently. I think I was most worried about how clients would perceive it, but really it hasn't had that much of an impact. The concerns were mostly just making sure everybody actually got everything done in those hours and wasn't continuing to go over, because we really wanted this to work. So we were really invested in making it work. But in terms of profitability and revenue, I think that what this has given us is a lot of clarity on where our time is the most valuable. At the end of 2021, for instance, we stopped publishing on our website. It was just not, for a few years there, you know, it was already not really seeing the same ROI as it had early on in TFD's years. And after, I think at that point, we had done the experiment, the 40 work week for about 6 months. And I just think we kind of, it had already been slowing down. And because our time was so much more valuable, we had to fit more into those hours, it just was becoming clearer that was not going to be a place where our hours were worth much compared to our other platforms, which have been able to grow, right? So we've also been able to, especially in the past year, we've started putting more time and effort behind things like our membership program, which is a lot of content behind our paywall. And we're seeing much more value from that and a lot higher ROI on our hours from that, because we have been able to just like so clearly focus on the channels that are actually making us money.
So interesting. What do you think of Bernie Sanders' proposal of a 4-day work week across the board?
I love the idea of it. I think it's a wonderful thought. I think it's really amazing that it's being talked about at a legislative level. I think it's a long shot that would ever pass at this juncture, but you know, crazier things have happened, I guess. I think it's an important reminder too that there are a lot of other things that America should be better at when it comes to work-life balance, and a lot of ways that we are still behind other countries that are not just the 4-day work week. I totally agree with Bernie. I obviously, like, I'm a big advocate for the 4-day work week. I think that for most jobs, it does make sense. I was reading even about a hospital system in a different country that adopted this recently. It worked perfectly fine. So I think it's very possible for a lot of other companies. I do think the bigger, you know, the bigger experiments, I think Microsoft Japan did one, the UK one you spoke of earlier, like those are going to be more relevant for a lot of companies than TFD, you know, or a very small team. But yeah, we're just behind in terms of healthcare, paid time off, parental leave. Like there are a lot of things that we should be doing at the legislative level, not just the 4-day work week. And I hope that this push starts pushing those forward as well.
Let's talk about your money. You have said that your financial life is quote unquote unimpressive. What do you mean? You work for a company called The Financial Diet. Clearly, you know what you're talking about. I'm impressed.
Oh, thank you. So I should say a lot of the book is tongue in cheek. And I think when I talk about someone like me having an unimpressive financial life, I'm purely talking about traditional markers of financial success, because I don't own a home and I don't own a business personally. And I think it is disingenuous and insensitive to say that someone like me isn't financially successful, because, you know, my husband and I both have good incomes. We have a robust emergency fund. We max out our retirement accounts. We are able to invest. Otherwise, we have a big nest egg and investments in addition to our retirement accounts. We take great trips every year. We have, I would say, a very high level of financial stability. We just don't own a home and we don't made a ton of money off of getting in on the ground floor of some big stock or something. My husband works in tech too, right? So he has all these friends who have giant sign-on bonuses for going to work for a big tech company or a startup and get stock options into that. And he has a much more traditional employment situation that has its own very good benefits that I think are worth it, but are not as flashy. So I think that I don't have the kind of financial life that I think is going to make any headlines, but I think I have, especially compared to the average American household, a very privileged and very financially successful life.
I agree with you. I think that the point that you make about investing alongside your retirement accounts, building wealth in some other way alongside your retirement accounts is right on the mark. What people forget about home ownership is that although we have had spikes in home values, specifically through the pandemic, for a long time, the price of a home basically just kept pace with inflation. You know, it went up a little bit every single year. And what you had, if you ever got to the end of a paid off mortgage, was basically a chunk of cash that you could either use to live in or you could use in some other way. You're building that chunk of cash in a different way. A lot of people say, okay, I'm not going to own, I'm going to rent and I'll invest the difference, and they never do. And you actually are doing that. So I think for approaching it in that direction, it's the right way. The other thing that sort of strikes me with your description about your financial life is that I would imagine that it's pretty stress-free, as much as a financial life can be stress-free these days. There's a study out that looked at when women were and when we were not stressed about money. And if we had emergency savings, which you do, if we had the ability to save at least 10%, which given that you're maxing out your retirement and investing on the side, you are, and if we had a plan, our levels of stress went down precipitously. So are you feeling that level of not being as stressed? And do you have a plan of where you want to go in the future?
Yeah, I definitely think that we have a really low level of money stress compared to most people. And that is really fantastic. And I think that should be the ultimate goal for anybody. I think what I try to talk about a lot in the book is that the things that are going to make us happy are what you're saying, are having more security, more of an emergency fund, more options, really, to be able to live the life you want. It's not going to be buying as much as possible. It's not going to be having a bigger home or a nicer car. It's not going to be having external markers of living a successful life. It's going to be having the security inside that you know that you are taken care of. My plan, I mean, frankly, I have to be thinking about this because I work in media and, you know, we never know.
yes, I know.
What that's going to look like in the future. I've been very lucky with my job at TFD. I've been here almost 8 years. I have been able to grow a lot with this company and we're in a very lucky period of growth right now. Like, it's not like everything is always so rosy, but I think we did a big pivot on our YouTube channel in the last 6 months, and it's been to doing shorter, fewer episodes, but longer form ones. So we're just doing one longer video essay a month rather than a bunch of shorter videos. And obviously we're still on TikTok and on Instagram and everything that we need to be, but I think that we're seeing really good momentum from that pivot. And I'm really excited to see where it goes from there, but I still have to be thinking about the future of my own career and all of that, right? So anything can happen at any time, and we just can't plan for it. So we have to plan to not be able to plan. And so I always advocate for having a second stream of income. I pick up side projects here and there. I think that's really important, not necessarily for the income, but just to have a softer place to land if something were to happen. My husband, like I said, he works at a much more traditional type of employer than a lot of tech jobs. And he's been with his company for 10 years, and he is in a very different position than a lot of people in tech. He has really great work-life balance, really great benefits, and a pension. And that's like so rare these days, and it's something we don't really want to give up. Obviously, I think he is, as far as you can predict job stability, I think he has good job stability, but, you know, whoever knows, right? So it's mostly like making the most of what we have while we have it, while also enjoying life. But it's balancing between living your life and planning for when you're not going to have this abundance in the future. So I think that saving a lot when times are good is really important.
It's really clear, not just in the title of the book, but in the book itself, that you are a fan of spending within reason to have the life you want. And you talk about the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early, and FIRE Bros specifically, as a community that sees personal finance as a game you can win by eliminating spending on anything that can possibly be seen as frivolous, which is, that's a quote right out of the book. What's your beef with the FIRE movement?
Okay, I do want to say, I know that was a very tongue-in-cheek little definition, and I do stand by that. I think that the FIRE movement has a certain stereotype that comes with it that is, you know, wealthy, very driven, but very frugal at the same time. They have these lifestyles where they make tons of money and then live very, very frugally in order to be able to save as much as possible and invest as much as possible so that they can retire by 40 or 35. And I don't really disparage anybody wanting to retire before a traditional retirement age. I personally, like, would love to retire as soon as it's possible for me. I love my work, but retirement to me would mean it's more, you know, having the option of work. So working on something that you care about, but not needing it, not relying on it to make money. So it's not like when I retire, I think I would not have any projects or wouldn't have any work. It would be a time when that was completely up to me and in my control. I think the FIRE bro stereotype can be really condescending and really judgmental. And it can often forget that the reason that those people are able to live that FIRE lifestyle is because they have an extremely highly unattainable income. And it's not necessarily because of their low spending, but they act as if the gamification, the keeping their spending low and the living on basically nothing while they are making so much, they act like that's the reason they are able to go after this lifestyle, when first and foremost, the reason they're able to go after it is because they make a lot of money.
I think that's a really good point. And I think often we don't know what influencers have going on behind the curtain, influencers of all types, and we should be a little bit more skeptical as we look at them. Emily White, who is a reporter and a social media strategist here at Her Money, started following the financial diet, you and Chelsea, when Chelsea put up a post acknowledging that as the CEO, Chelsea's not the highest paid person at your company, and that is okay, and that more money is not necessarily the best thing. It's a very interesting viewpoint, particularly from the CEO. I want to dig into that and talk to you about the intersection of money and life and happiness. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick break. Let's address a crucial topic and one of our hot button issues here at Her Money: women outliving their retirement savings. It's a huge problem, but it's one Parity Flex, the multi-year guaranteed annuity available from Gainbridge, is designed to fix. If you're not familiar with annuities, the concept is essentially that you take a chunk of money and turn it into a paycheck that you can start drawing on when you want to, next year or next decade. With guaranteed returns at 5.95% APY, the Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity also features a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit, which ensures a consistent income even if your account balance is zero. And if there's one thing better than a successful retirement, it's a stress-free retirement. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for important information. This is a paid endorsement. If you're listening to this show, you're probably already investing in your 401k, yay, balancing your budget carefully, and planning exactly how you want your retirement to look. But there's one important thing on your checklist that you might be missing: life insurance. I got life insurance for the first time when I had a child. Why? Because I knew that life insurance is income insurance. And as soon as you have somebody else depending on your income or your time, which would cost money to replace, you need life insurance. You want to cross this off your list fast. SelectQuote can offer up to $2 million in instant affordable coverage with no medical exam required. Plus, quotes are completely free and take only minutes. I know you're busy, but do me a favor. Take a couple of minutes today to get your free quote. Go to SelectQuote.com. That's SelectQuote.com. You are going to feel so good checking this big item off your to-do list. And you'll find details on that sample rate at selectquote.com. We're talking with Holly Trantham, author of the new book, Beyond Getting By. So, Holly, I want to get into something that you push back on in the book, and that's the notion of a happiness threshold, the idea that once you have a certain amount of money, your happiness plateaus. How much money is enough? And how is it correlated to happiness as you think about it?
Yeah. So what I push back on in the book is the idea that there is one salary number that once anybody makes past that number, they're not going to be any happier. There was a really famous study several years ago that I'm sure you heard about. You probably even talked about it here, that past $75,000 a year, no one's going to be any happier. And I can tell you from my personal experience living in New York City, that's absolutely not true. I think that everybody has that ceiling where they're going to have diminishing returns on the happiness that money can bring them. I don't think that is going to be the same number for everyone. And I think that you have to kind of determine that for yourself.
I completely agree. That said, where do you shake out on having more money? I mean, clearly you're a big believer and your company, The Financial Diet, is a big believer in this idea of time is more valuable than money, or at least equally valuable. Where's the trade-off?
For me, it's basically, I make a certain amount of money. If I wanted to make more by taking on a freelance project, a side income, or something like that, is that extra income going to be worth the time it's going to take me? And sometimes that can be yes, and sometimes it's going to be no. I think that the target's going to be ever moving. I don't have any kids right now. That could change in the future, and I'm certain that would change the amount of money that we would want to be able to have access to. You know, I do live in a high cost of living area. We have a lot of expenses we don't have living in New York. I don't have a car payment. I don't have gas and car insurance like that, but I do have higher housing costs than a lot of places. And that's a big trade-off. But I think that it's ultimately what I talk a lot about in the book is you have to determine what's actually worth your spending your money on. Because I think when we talk about happiness, when we talk about how money can buy happiness, you have to decide, are you talking about tangible and experiential things money can buy you? Or are you talking about security? Because I think when you talk about security and that being something money can buy you, I think that's a lot more important for happiness than buying all the clothes you want or going on flashy Instagram vacations. And I think it's kind of, you have to find the trade-off. And I think a lot of people get caught up in these, like I said, these external markers and things that we think are going to make us happy in lieu of saving more for the future, putting more in investments, building a nest egg, giving yourself and your future self more options. So I feel like right now, my husband and I make enough money, we are able to contribute to our future selves, to that nest egg and to those investments plenty, and in a way that I don't want to work more because I know I'm working towards those goals. But if I was making less money, I would probably want to be at the level I am now. So, and you know, as our living costs go up, our grocery bills are way higher than they were a year or two ago. That's going to keep happening too. So I think it's always a moving target. But I think you just have to say, am I on track where I want to be? And that's a really difficult question to answer. I do think that it's really important to continue looking at retirement calculators, online net worth calculators, and growth suggestions and make the decision for yourself. But I think once you decide you're on track, you can just pause and not worry it for the moment And if you need to reassess in the future, then you do that.
Thinking of your future self is not something that human beings are particularly good at. In fact, it's something that we are really bad at, because that future self, that me 30 years from now, is a total stranger, right? I don't know her. I don't know what she's going to want. I don't know what she's going to need. It makes it hard to empathize with her and the situation that my current behavior is putting her in. Clearly, you've got a grip on this. How did you get yourself to focus on your future self?
I think a lot of introspection over the years, frankly. I'm currently in kind of a no-spend challenge just for myself, because I am saving for a solo trip I'm going to take this summer. And, you know, it's something I probably could figure out how to pay for without cutting off all of my personal spending. But I kind of, sometimes you find yourself getting into these cycles where you're buying more. And for me, it's always clothes. Buying more than you need. And you get to a point where you realize it's not really adding to your life. I think it's really important for me to just continue to reassess my spending, where my money is going, and what's actually adding value to my life. I think I've done a pretty good job of making that a habit over the years. I think for me, I had to start doing the pay yourself first method, right? Where you set up direct deposit, you have money taken out of your paycheck, my husband's paychecks, money that's taken out that goes to investing and savings goals before we ever see it. So it's just not even part of our day-to-day budget. Frankly, I think for me, the biggest motivator is starting that habit and giving it time for that money to grow. Because when we look at our investing account from the past, we started our combined nest egg account. It's kind of like, oh, we've seen it grow so much over the last 4 years, even with 2022. We've seen that amount grow without us really doing anything other than setting up those recurring contributions. And if we get a bonus or something, it goes into that. I think just setting up the habit and then waiting to see how that's paying off is the biggest motivator. Because if this is how much that can pay off in 4 years, think about how much it's going to pay off in 20 or 30 years. That's the easiest way I can think of my future self, especially when I look at a calculator and say, oh, if we have X amount by the time we're 50 and we might be able to retire then, that's really motivating to me. So, you know,
I think that's great. And I do think that the time to let it grow, to see, I mean, you're showing yourself that you're successful. And a lot of people don't give themselves that. And that is a really powerful motivator. Every time I write a book, Holly, I learn something new that I didn't think I was going to learn before I set out to write that book. What was it that you learned writing this book? What's the biggest overarching surprising lesson?
I don't know if I would say it's surprising, but I think that the biggest lesson I learned writing this book is the importance of community. And I think how especially living abundantly is so much a mindset of generosity and a generosity of spirit as much as money. Everybody I spoke to, whether it was Eve Rodsky talking about the idea of unicorn spaces and creating these anti-burnout outlets, taking an interest in your own life, to Tiffany Dufu talking about her concept of dropping the ball, which is her book that she wrote about domestic labor and creating more equitable home lives, to Ryan Houlihan, I talked to her about forming a union. I think that the importance of your relationships and community is what it comes down to in every aspect, because the way you avoid burnout isn't just by having a 40-day work week. It's by having an interest in your own life and having relationships with people, having a robust social life that's not just revolving around your family and your work. Having an equitable home life means you have an open, honest, mutually supportive relationship, whether that's with a spouse or a partner or partners or, you know, a roommate. And I think we kind of look at personal finance sometimes as a set of individual decisions, when in reality, our relationship with money has a lot to do with our relationships with other people, especially as you earn more. I think it is important to strive to earn more over the course of your career, but as you earn more, it's also equally as important to say, how am I helping others benefit from what I've learned from all of this? How am I helping others up the ladder behind me? How am I mentoring? How am I sponsoring people coming up behind me? So I do think, yeah, just the importance of community and our interpersonal relationships.
Well, Thank you for sharing all of this with us. I should point out both Eve Rodsky and Tiffany Dufu have been guests on this show. If you haven't heard those interviews, please feel free to go back and check them out. They're definitely in our library. Holly Trantham, the book is Beyond Getting By. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so wonderful, and I am such a fan, so thank you so much.
Aw, thank you very much, and we'll be right back with your mailbag. Hey, you guys, it's Jean. I want to tell you about another podcast I think you'll love because I love it, Freakonomics Radio. Every week, host and best-selling author Stephen Dubner dives into the hidden side of business and economics and so much more. He interviews CEOs, historians, even Nobel laureates to explore all kinds of topics like whether AI has a sense of humor and whether two CEOs are better than one. If you are curious like me and just looking to better understand the world around you, you will find it on Freakonomics Radio. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And we are back for Mailbag. Catherine Tuggle is joining me. I love the whole success of the financial diet, I have to say. Like, having these incredible women in our space talking about money in a way that's different than we talk about money, I just think it lifts the boats, right? What's the expression?
The rising tide lifts all boats.
Yes, that.
Well, you know, I think about it in the context of budgeting methods. There are 8 gazillion budgeting methods on the market because what works for you is not going to be what works for me. What clicks in your brain is not going to be what clicks in my brain. So I love the fact that we have so many voices in this space because somebody's going to say something that is going to be the light that dawns for you.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you listen to enough different voices, hopefully you find it. I know we've got some longer questions today, so I want to make sure that we have time for them. Can you dig in?
Yeah, some really insightful questions today. Our first question comes to us from Tracy. She writes, "Hi, Harmony team. I had sent in a question about paying for egg freezing. Thank you for the thoughtful response on the podcast. I saw in a Harmony.com story that you mentioned that FSAs will cover egg, embryo, and sperm storage. My experience has not been so straightforward. I work for the federal government and was told by my FSA that they only cover egg storage if it's medically necessary. Do you have any tips on how to handle this? The kind operator on the phone told me my only recourse was to write letters advocating for policy change, but I wonder if there's something more viable I can do to get this, quote, medically unnecessary cost covered by my FSA. I find it sexist and unfair that Viagra is covered by FSAs, but egg storage is not. Do you know of anyone who has been able to get egg storage covered successfully by their FSA? Are FSAs different depending on who you work for? Thank you so much for all your work. It really makes a difference."
Well, thank you for writing. I'm sorry that you're having so much trouble with this. And before I dive into it, let me just explain a couple of terms, terminology. FSA is a flexible spending account. It is your own money that comes out of your paycheck via a paycheck withdrawal that your employer sets up, and it goes into an account that can be used to pay for some medical and sometimes dependent care expenses. HSA is a health savings account. Again, your money that goes into an account that can be used to pay for some healthcare-related expenses. You can't use an HSA and an FSA at the same time, but often the same expenses that are covered by an HSA are the ones that will also be covered by an FSA, meaning essentially that you can use these pre-tax funds to pay for these medical expenses. And I bring up HSAs as part of this conversation because the rules for health savings accounts right now are the rules for flexible spending accounts right now. And essentially, what it says is that you can get fees for storage reimbursed from your FSA or HSA up to a 12-month period. So this is a temporary fix at its best. I think that the customer service rep who was helping you was a little bit confused in the way that she was telling you to write a letter, because what you need is something called a letter of medical necessity. And it's a letter that comes from a doctor, like a doctor's note, and it has to outline how your reproductive issues related to a medical condition necessitates this storage, how the storage will be used to alleviate or deal with the issue, and how long the storage is needed for. Again, the fees for the storage will not be reimbursed at all if the storage exceeds 12 months. So if you've got IVF going on, you're going to store your eggs for a short term until you get to implantation, then it's possible to have the fees reimbursed. Do we think that this is fair when, as you point out, Viagra is an eligible expense? We do not. It would be great if we could change the laws, and maybe if we were able to come up with a concerted letter writing campaign, we could get the rules changed. I'm thinking of how long it took just to get period products covered. And it's just another example of the horrendous pink tax. So I'm sorry that I don't have better news for you.
Yeah, it's great insight, though, Jean. And definitely, I know that this is not easy to navigate for so many women. Not that that makes it any better, but this is definitely called a fertility journey for a reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we've got one more.
Yep. Our next question comes to us from Shannon. She writes, "Hi, Jean. I recently graduated with a master's degree in engineering, and I've had several interviews at three different companies. I feel like I've messed up every single one and have been rejected after every interview. What makes me so sad is that these are top-tier companies. I feel like my lack of self-confidence and my shy and introverted nature is making me come across as not the best person for the job. How do I prepare better for my next interview?"
Oh, first of all, Shannon, I'm really sorry that you are going through this. I do have a couple of suggestions, and there's absolutely no rocket science in what I'm about to tell you, but there is 40 years of experience being interviewed. You've got to practice, and you've got to practice answering the questions that they are likely to ask you in a number of different ways. When I was starting to appear on the Today Show, I knew that I was going to have a very small number of minutes to convey some important information. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't waste time, that I was really clear, but also that I made the points that I wanted to make. And so I went through this incredibly detailed practice process for every interview that I had. I was always talking about some story in one of the magazines that I was working for typically. And I would take that story, generally an 8 or 10 page story, and I would condense it into what I thought were likely to be the most important questions. I'd write out really long form answers to those questions. And then I would do a back and forth practice, sometimes just with myself, asking myself the questions and answering them and shrinking my answers down until I got each answer down from 2 minutes to a minute to 30 seconds. Sometimes I would have other people ask me the questions, and then I would try to throw myself by having the questions asked different ways. And I learned not only to deal with fluctuations in the questions, but also to deal with the questions that weren't asked, but that I wanted to answer anyway because I knew the information was important. I learned to really quickly say, the answer to that is X, but what you really need to know about this is Y. And then I would explain why, because that was what I wanted to say in the first place. And so I think that you need to do a little bit of that. You can hire a coach to help you, but you can also just record yourself. You can do it in front of your computer. You can do it with a friend. I would really give it time. to practice. I'd also make sure, of course, that you've done your homework on these top-tier companies and also on the person or people that you're going to be interviewing with, because there's so much information out there about them. There is no excuse for not knowing before you walk in the room. Be prepared with some questions that you want to ask them, but I suspect that these might be Zoom interviews. And I think the Zoom interview process hurts introverts. I think that people who don't have a personality that jumps off the screen, and I know this actually from my husband because he is a career coach, we've talked about it, you may have to artificially raise your energy level to compensate for the fact that you're not sitting in front of a person, that you can't lean in. Like, you want to make sure that you appear as excited about these opportunities as I can tell from your letter that you are. So practice, compensate, homework. Let us know what happens. You'll get one. I know you will.
Definitely. Some of the best advice I ever heard about going on a Zoom interview was to pretend like you're on a first date with Ooh. Somebody that you really want to impress, and you're just going to be more engaged. You're going to be kind of hanging on their every word. You're going to be showing a real interest, and I think that that helps because a screen is just so one-dimensional. You don't get a feel for somebody.
No.
Unless they are projecting more than they normally would.
Yeah, you have to use your eyes and really look at the camera. And it's hard if you haven't really had a lot of experience doing it before. But we're rooting for you.
Definitely. Let us know how it goes.
If you have any other money-related questions, we'd love to hear from you. Just send them our way by emailing us at mailbag@hermoney.com. And now we're going to take a quick break. We are back. Thanks so much for joining me today on Her Money. Thanks to Holly Trantham for sharing how she's redefined financial success. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our show at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. We love hearing what you think. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Edelman Financial Engines. Her Money is produced by Haley Pascalides. This show is mixed and mastered by CDM Sound Studios. Our music is provided by Video Helper, and our show comes to you through Megaphone. Check out our new podcast, How She Does It with Karen Feinerman, for intimate cocktail party style conversations with today's most talented female leaders. This podcast is also part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. You can find us and other shows like us at airwavemedia.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk soon.